Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the April 1st, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, thanks for tuning in to our program on this Palm Sunday, where for the next hour we will talk about our nation's space program. And focus today on plans at least some folks are making to continue exploring our own moon with both robots and humans, a topic that I agree is not the least bit foolish to consider on this April Fool's Day. You are welcome, of course, to join in on our conversation by asking a question or making a comment about anything having to do with our space program. Give me a call during the program at 321-768-1240. Or if you'd prefer to send us something by email, the address we monitor all the time here in the studio is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, it is April Fool's Day today. I don't have any pranks to play, although I was very tempted. But in any case, so for today's edition of Orbital Inclinations... Okay, I thought I would lighten things up a bit and share with you a version of one of my favorite space-related jokes inspired by one I once heard during a previous century at a space congress in Cocoa Beach, in which, of course, we dedicate to the late, great Martin Kaden. And so it's really bad, folks. Stand by. Here it comes. In the far future, two astronauts, let's call them Charlie and Jake, names which have nothing to do with the fact that I'm always hungry for some good barbecue, have safely landed on an alien planet in another solar system, no doubt originally discovered by NASA's Kepler Observatory. The landing was not without peril, however. The planet's gravity was uneven. The atmosphere was filled with some strange gases and strong wind currents, and the ground was covered with exotic vegetation, all of which made it extremely challenging to find a suitable place to touch down. The heat from reentry was higher than expected, and that, in combination with some extreme turbulence, wreaked havoc with the spacecraft's various systems. Unfortunately, the first thing to fail was the ship's communication system, leaving the astronauts with no way to stay in touch with mission control or to call for help if they needed it. After landing, Charlie and Jake assessed the situation, took a sample of the air outside, and quickly determined it was okay to open up the hatch, get out, and explore this new world without needing the protection of their spacesuits. Charlie was the first out as commander and climbed down the ladder in a scene very reminiscent of Apollo, stepping on to the new planet for the first time, but with no communication system to relay his historic words back to Earth, Charlie decided to go for something obscure and quoted Groucho Marx as he stepped on the surface saying, "Time flies like an arrow, fruit flies like a banana." Jake couldn't believe his ears and just shook his head. Charlie was always saying the weirdest things, and Jake wasn't quite sure if his commander really had his act together. Sometimes Charlie would just state the obvious and leave everyone else scratching their heads. Anyway, Jake quickly joined Charlie on the planet's surface and they began to look around. The sky was a reddish color, while the clouds appeared to have a sort of bluish tint to them. Neither astronaut was quite sure of the chemistry involved that would generate such a thing, but that was what they were there to do, explore a strange new world. In the days that followed, Charlie and Jake settled into a routine and easily went about their business. They found a variety of fruits and vegetables that were safe to eat, and they were quite tasty and nutritious. Although they were out of touch with mission control, all was going well, and the crew looked forward to blasting off for the return trip to home. It was on the day they were scheduled to blast off that the trouble came. All packed up and ready to go, the countdown clock hit zero, Jake pushed the button to light the engine, and nothing happened. Trained as they were for all sorts of contingencies, Charlie and Jake didn't panic, but their hearts started beating quicker, and they both got a healthy rush of adrenaline pumping through their bodies. As they continued to work through the problem, they encountered more and more difficulties. Nothing was working as it was supposed to. As the situation grew graver, Charlie and Jake's skin suddenly broke out in some kind of a rash, apparently a reaction to their high stress in combination with the alien plants they had been eating and the air they had been breathing. Splotches of a sort of reddish-purple color quickly covered their bodies as they hit the rocket ignition button for one last attempt. Nothing happened, and it suddenly began to dawn on Charlie and Jake that they were going to be spending a much longer time on this planet. Charlie saw his reflection in one of the cockpit instruments and then looked over at Jake. The skin of both men had turned a completely different color that reminded Charlie of this planet's purplish sky seen at sunset. There was nothing more to do. The spaceship wouldn't lift off, and they were stuck there. Charlie looked at Jake's beet-covered face, summed up the situation, and said, "Well, it looks like we've been marooned." And that's this week's April Fool's edition of Orbital Inclinations. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes here before we do take our first break. And I'm not sure if anyone at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California is listening to this show on iHeartRadio or the live streaming on the WMMB webpage. In fact, after that bad joke, I'm not sure anyone's listening at all. But I do like to offer a shout-out to the United Launch Alliance team that's out west trying to get a Delta IV rocket off the ground this weekend. The liftoff was supposed to have taken place on Thursday, and then a concern about the RL-10 engine on the second stage prompted a delay. And now their next chance to fly will be early tomorrow evening, Monday afternoon, their time, 7:04 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, again out at the west coast on the California coast. Although the forecast for wind conditions is rather pessimistic, they only have about a 30% chance of good weather. Situation doesn't improve much for a launch opportunity on Tuesday if needed. So if you do happen to have a friend or family in California this weekend supporting the launch, it may be a few more days before they'll be able to get home. And they should find plenty of things to do out there. Lompoc is the city. It's kind of their Cocoa Beach next to Vandenberg Air Force Base. And I have been out there one time in 1989. Vandenberg is a huge place. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to get out there. I hope all of you do at some point in your lives and careers. It's a huge place compared to the Cape. Cape Canaveral, much more, believe it or not, an intimate location for launching rockets by comparison. At Vandenberg, of course, you have mountains all around the place. The Delta IV launching from Space Launch Complex 6, or what they like to call Slick 6, that was the launch pad that was built for the space shuttle program when there was the consideration to launch DOD missions from the West Coast into polar orbits. Bob Crippen, our former KSC director, was going to be the commander of the first launch, probably around 1986. Of course, Challenger happened and wound up putting a hold to all those plans. But Vandenberg Air Force Base, definitely an important part of our space program and very much working in complementary fashion with what we do here at the Cape, launching rockets to the east. Well, anyways, we get ready to take our first break. The phone line's open for your questions and comments about the space program. 321-768-1240 is the phone number. spacetalking@AOL.com is the email. Stay tuned now. We'll come back and talk about lunar science and lunar engineering and all that kind of stuff. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If it's happening, space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. Again, now at its new time slot of 3 p.m. every Sunday, right here on WMMB. A reminder that we're open for your phone calls, questions, and comments. 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in our program. Or you can send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. As some of you did last week, we weren't able to get to everybody's questions as we were talking with students from the Da Vinci Aerospace Academy at Merritt Island High School. A great, great program that is now archived online. Go to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and you'll find the links to the archives and all of that. Well, let's get started today into today's topic, introduce my guests, one of which is in the studio, two of which is online with us on the telephone. It's been nearly 40 years since Apollo 17 Commander Gene Cernan walked on the moon. And despite that length of time, I refuse to consider Gene the last man to walk on the moon. Instead, when we are together or I have a chance to introduce him, I always call him the most recent man to walk on the moon. And that's because I believe with all my heart that we will return to the moon one day. Although sometimes I am less sure that the next humans to walk there will speak English. But putting aside the politics of space, there should be no argument that we still have much to learn about our nearest neighbor in space. And I am among those who don't think it's a good idea to go to Mars until we have tested out everything first by making extended stays on the moon. Although there is no formal declared plan with a deadline for going back to the moon, there are folks out there making preparations now for what we all believe is the eventuality of returning. I'm pleased to have some of those forward-thinking engineers and managers with me today, all of whom represent a aerospace startup company called Flexure Engineering. And I want to introduce everyone by name and title, and then we'll let everybody brag about themselves a bit and their company. We'll get into the meat of our discussion. First, joining me in the studio here today, Bonnie DeBrow, marketing and training manager here. Welcome, Bonnie. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And for helping us arrange all that. And then on the phone, you're going to have to tell me where you guys are. The CEO of Flexure Engineering, Russell Cox, and the founder and chief engineer of the company, Gregory Sharfstein. Russ, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you. Yes, I'm out here in lovely Seattle. The rain stopped this morning and the sun came out.
Oh, really? The Pacific Northwest. Watch out for Sasquan, right? And Gregory Sharfstein. Greg, where are you at? Are you with them or are you somewhere else?
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having us. I'm calling from Berkeley, California.
Okay, so we've got all the coast represented and the three of the four corners of the United States anyway. Well, that's cool. Well, let's get started here. Greg, I guess as the founder of the company, we'll start with you. And just give us sort of the first of all, a little bit about your background, and then a little bit about the company and why did you start it?
Sure. Thanks, Jim. So I worked for Johns Hopkins University for about 9 years developing one-of-a-kind, first-of-a-kind scientific instruments, and left Hopkins in October 2008 to start Flexure Engineering and to leverage that really one-of-a-kind education and hands-on experience I got there. And quickly found Russell, and Russell started out as the business coach and then soon became CEO. And so we're an aerospace startup just over 3 years old. We are a virtual company, so we're seven strong, and we're all across the country, and that allows us to do business just about anywhere. And we do bring three core capabilities with us. One is ultra-low temperature engineering. So this is engineering systems that operate at, like, liquid hydrogen and liquid helium temperatures, right, so on and so forth. Our second capability is creating and producing multidisciplinary workshops that foster collaboration. And then third, we'd love to organize and lead proposal teams to find funding, because at the end of the day, we all got to get paid.
Yeah, so not only the engineering, but then helping spread the word and then helping folks get that business to continue doing the good work then. That sounds like quite an interesting mix for a startup company. Russ, give us a little bit quick about your background and how you come to all of this.
Yeah, so thank you. So I've been interested. I grew up in Houston, Texas back in the 60s, so I've been interested in the moon ever since I was a very young man. And so I've been going back and forth studying math and physics, studying planetary science and lunar science when I could. And as I began working with Greg Sharfstein, he was supporting the James Webb Space Telescope, right, which has as its key feature it operates at 40 degrees above absolute zero. Then the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter got to the moon, and they proved that the lunar poles are that cold. No one imagined they were that cold, but they measured temperatures down to 25 degrees above absolute zero. And so Greg's engineering expertise suddenly became very relevant to the moon. And then a few months later, I woke up one day and said, oh, yeah, high-temperature superconductors work at 40 degrees above absolute zero. So I called the Texas Center for Superconductivity, where they invented high-temperature superconductors, and said, do you think this could apply? And they said, absolutely. And we just created our second workshop with them. And so that's my role, is to go find the scientists and forward thinkers who can use this engineering and create opportunities for them to do really cool science and exploration using the type of engineering that Greg is an expert at.
You know, Russ, if you sound like you're the kind of guy that is after my own heart, if you're going to wake up from a dream thinking about, you know, high energy or high temperature superconducting and how it applies to cryogenics or whatever. I mean, that's good nerdy stuff. We appreciate that on this program, no doubt about it. Bonnie, let's talk about you a little bit. What's your background? How do you come into this? And then talk about, you know, you're here on the Space Coast. You know, what's Flexure Engineering's role here on the Space Coast?
Sure. I've been living in Brevard County since 1980, and so have felt, heard, and seen shuttle launches and rocket launches. I am a business coach, trainer. I worked at Harris in Total Quality. I've been in professional sales, so I have a very eclectic background that the position with Flexure allows me to bring everything to the table, and that's part of why I love the job and why I'm on the team.
So part of the role in organizing conferences, we'll talk about some of those a little bit later in the program, but that part of all of that kind of, you know, the management of everything is kind of the part you bring in as opposed to the science and engineering.
Correct.
Okay. And Greg, I want you to elaborate a little bit. When you talk about the James Webb telescope, is that, of course, that's the big replacement for Hubble, and, you know, there's whole other issues there, budget and political, we won't get into. But from the technical side, you talk about working at super cold. Now, around here, when we talk about super cold and we use the word cryogenics, we're always thinking about propellant. We're always thinking about loading the liquid hydrogen and the liquid oxygen before a launch of a rocket or the fuel cells for the space shuttle or whatever. But that's not exactly what you're talking about when you talk about working with super cold, is it? Can you kind of elaborate on the James Webb and how you guys have been involved in that?
Sure, no problem. So on James Webb, I led a team that developed some optomechanical alignment fixtures for the four cameras of the telescope, all of which had to operate at these super cold temperatures. And the reason why we're knocking on Kennedy's door and why we're in Brevard County is because there's probably no better place on this planet where you have expertise and facilities of people that have been doing this kind of stuff for decades, not so much with the optical piece, but just building systems that operate and make, you know, and servicing them at these really cold temperatures.
Right.
And what we're so pleased about is just the open arms that we're getting inside Kennedy and with the small businesses around Kennedy that support it, just saying, yeah, you know, we want to find new ways to collaborate. We want to find new business models to put all this expertise and these facilities to use. And that's where we're at right now. We're leveraging my expertise in the super low temperature engineering and packaging it with some of the heritage at Kennedy, and I think that we're going to see some great things come out of it.
Greg, you used the term as something about optomechanical alignment. Is that the term you used or something like that?
Optomechanical. So that's just simply how do you hold optics, lenses, and such at these very cold temperatures so that they can operate.
Because as the temperatures fluctuate, I imagine the mechanical properties shrink or expand or whatever, and if you've got to maintain a very solid lock on a very tiny object very far away, you somehow have to account for that movement in the material. Is that kind of where you're headed? Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly correct.
Okay, and so what are we not? I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand is what's the state of the art? What are we trying to learn that we don't know how to do that we're trying to figure out to make James Webb work?
So let me jump in on that one.
Go ahead.
The test he ran on James Webb I describe as measuring microns on meters. So he had this alignment fixture to help align the cameras, and in order to do that properly, every nut and bolt on that fixture had to be precisely measured down to the micron level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we used a laser radar to look through a window into a cryogenic chamber to measure those locations of all of the devices, many of which Greg had built, and verify that they really did work exactly correctly at 30 Kelvin. And where that comes into what we're doing now is taking that laser radar head and moving it inside the chamber so that the actual instrument itself isn't looking through a window anymore. Okay. It, too, is operating at these very cold temperatures. And that's the sort of thing we're going to need to do to be able to finish James Webb in a timely manner. And more importantly, that's exactly the sort of laser radar head you're going to need on a lunar rover when it's driving around on the lunar surface at 40 degrees above absolute zero.
Yeah, working in those super cold temperatures is definitely something that we need to learn more about how to do. We're going to get into all this talk about lunar science, lunar exploration, how this all fits in now to our nearest neighbor in Earth. When we come back, we're going to take a break here, pause for our usual five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. We'll get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And then when we come back, we'll talk some more about exploring the moon with my guests from Flexure Engineering. Your call is always welcome, 321-768-1240. I'm Jim Benke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Benke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone line's open for your contributions to the conversation we're having today about, well, super cold stuff, lunar exploration, with some folks from a company called Flexure Engineering. Give us a call, 321-768-1240. Email your questions or comments to spacetalking@AOL.com. Once again, in the studio with us, we have Bonnie DeBrow, who's basically the marketing training person, the management expertise perhaps of some of all this. Russell Cox, the CEO, is with us, and Gregory Sharfstein, also with us on the phone from Seattle and California, and I'm not sure if that was respectively or backwards. But in any case, three corners of the country covered. And we were talking about the company, talking about your plans to do some neat things, and we want to focus this segment on the activity on the moon. Irrespective of the politics and the space policy of when we're going to go back and who's going to go and how that's all going to be done, the point is that plans need to be made now to go explore the moon. And I'm reminded of reading my history of about Apollo, even before Kennedy set the goal and we as a country officially announced Project Apollo. There had been folks working for years about going to the moon and how you're going to do it and what we might do when we get there. I imagine Russ and Greg, I don't know which one wants to take this, but we're in the same boat now. We don't really know when as humans we're going back, but we've already spent robots. We've got more plans to do so, and there's still a lot more to learn up there. Talk to us for a little bit about why we should go back to the moon and what we hope to do when we get there in terms of the science and the engineering. Russ, I'll start off with this and then hand
it off to Greg for a second. But I've been watching the lunar science for 30 years since I was 8 years old in 1968. And the first thing is when NASA goes to the moon, we usually have by far the best technology. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, there's two new missions, one called GRAIL, a new one called LADEE. The science we do when we get there is really stunning. But at the same time, there are five other nations going to the moon. Japan, Europe, Russia, India, and the Chinese have all sent missions to the moon in the last few years, and they're all going back. Right. And also, especially for me, being an entrepreneur, even more importantly, there are 25 Google XPRIZE teams, and they're all trying to go. And at least three or four of them will almost certainly make it. So it's actually very credible to believe that there will be many, many missions to the moon in the next decade or so. And one of the things we want to do is be able to get the scientists opportunities to hitch rides on those missions and really expand that and create really for the first time a true global community of scientists and explorers who want to go to the moon. And NASA will play an important role in that. Right now, we'll probably take a little pause for a couple of years as the Congress decides what they want to do next. But the actually the amount of traffic going to the moon in the next decade, it's kind of baked into the cake. There are lots of folks wanting to go back. Greg, give us a couple minutes on your thoughts.
Sure, thank you. And what I want to focus on is the discoveries from LRO, in particular the Diviner instrument, which is telling us how really cold it is on the moon, especially at the poles. There are craters where at the bottom of those craters, sun has never, ever touched, and it is extremely cold. And we also know from LCROSS, the impactor, that there is a lot of interesting chemistry and different volatiles and ices on the moon that we are sure that these exist, and we want to go up there and check them out. We want to dig them up, and we want to put them inside a chamber and heat them up and see what boils off. And even to do that, at these very cold temperatures, we need to figure out how to send rovers and such down to the bottom of these craters that can simply just grab a little bit of soil at these very cold temperatures and very delicately start to heat it up and see what's in there. And we're at a point now where even one data point on the surface of the moon can really change things for a lot of the lunar science that has been discovered in the last couple of years. And we are just really excited about that.
Well, guys, when we talk about the lunar science and you mentioned the discoveries that can happen, I'm thinking, of course, as usual, we send the robots first, followed by the humans. And, you know, how much do you think what the robots are going to learn, these various spacecraft that you've just mentioned and some of these experiments that will be done up there, will inform what we want to do with humans? And how much of this is science for just the sake of pure knowledge? And how much of this do you think, guys, we need to work on in terms of the engineering to make it possible for us as humans to safely go back and live there and even live off the land there? All of this is the kind of stuff that's on your plate, do you think?
Absolutely. It's really exciting. Another piece of science that was recently discovered by NASA satellites is that there are small magnetic fields in different parts of the moon. And most people thought they were too small to provide any real radiation protection. But it turns out even these very small magnetic fields that are there naturally provide much more shielding than people had guessed. Now that we've gone and measured them, there's a new mission called Artemis that arrived about a year ago. And they've done some measurements, and they found out that those are much more effective than people thought, which means that using magnetic shielding for radiation shielding, which is the one last unsolved manned technology. You can't send people to the moon. You certainly can't send them to Mars without being able to protect them from deep space radiation and the occasional solar flares, which provide deadly radiation.
Right.
So it turns out that by studying the magnetic fields that are already there, that's science, we can learn about how we would build a radiation shield for exploration. And, oh, by the way, any magnetic radiation shield is going to be powered by superconducting magnets, some of which are there or being developed in Brevard County. One of our partners there has a NASA grant to explore superconducting radiation shielding for human protection. But it begins with trying to understand how those fields and processes actually already work in space. So the science and the robots precede and create the engineering you need to do exploration. And then the final economic benefit is now that we know the LCROSS experiment proved there is a lot of water ice on the moon in certain locations, you can turn that into fuel. And what is rocket fuel? Rocket fuel is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. You guys in Brevard know more about that than anybody on planet Earth.
Yeah.
We want to mine it on the moon, store it in orbit, and we're hopefully going to be partnering with some folks there at Kennedy in the next year or two on some of their new research into how do you store hydrogen very efficiently.
And when I want to go back to LCROSS for a minute. When LCROSS, you know, hit the moon, the impactor, and, of course, the headlines were, you know, we're bombing the moon and all of that and all the jokes that were made from that, and it really, really missed the point of the fact that there was the discovery, the proof that there was so much water up there. But then we say, well, you know, why? And then we say, well, we're going to take the water and turn it into propellant. We're going to mine the lunar resources and get stuff out of it. And it's like, you know, something we all can do in high school chemistry classes, which maybe we can. But now take that problem onto the moon. I mean, how tough is that to do what you just said so simply, is so matter-of-factly, to turn ice in lunar regolith into hydrogen oxygen, store it, you know, pump it into a container and turn it into a rocket stage? How tough is that?
That's a great question, and It's extremely challenging, and probably the first challenging piece is building robots that can operate at those low temperatures on a reliable basis over many, many years without being serviced or by servicing themselves. That's one of the biggest cryogenic challenges right now, because a lot of the instruments that are developed, especially on James Webb, they have a limited lifetime of operability. And they're also not, as far as mechanisms go, when you think about a robot going down to the bottom of a crater and digging up regolith and mining it, cameras on James Webb have very limited mobility. So the first step in the engineering piece is building robots that can rove and move over large distances and work for many years and service themselves.
You know, I hear you guys talk. You can hear the energy. You can hear the excitement of what you do. And I want to get your reaction to some of these things, especially what we've talked about that's been in the news this past week, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, as more and more of that data comes down, and we're finding more and more artifacts on the moon. Lunokhod, the Russian rover that was on the moon back in the 70s, has been discovered. We see better and better shots of Apollo 11's landing site and all that. The talk this week about Jeff Bezos from Amazon wanting to recover the F1 engines that are part of the Apollo Saturn V. I'm particularly enamored and looking forward to the idea that Tom Hanks is now producing a film based on our favorite Mattel toy when we were kids, Major Matt Mason. You know, there's all this excitement and nostalgia about the moon that the general public has, and yet it doesn't seem to be reflected in our national policy. And again, I don't need you guys to start bashing Congress or giving me your politics, but I am curious, as guys are excited about doing this, you know, are you buoyed by that excitement? Do you share that excitement about the moon with the public? And why is it, do you think, that we're so excited about the moon when there's such a prevalence of the been there, done that attitude? Bonnie, you want to take that?
I'll jump in on that one. We're excited about the moon because every night we look at it. It's our moon. And it's fascinating. It's still fascinating. The three of us, everybody in our company, and the people that we talk to are excited because it's close by. It's of all the places we can go. It's got a lower risk. It's going to be more economical. We're going to be able to achieve more, accomplish more faster by playing in our own backyard. And so, yeah, we're excited.
Yeah, and Russ and Greg, I'm not sure which one of you again want to take this question, but as you guys are out there doing your business and talking to folks, you know, you're seeing the interest, you know the people are interested, and I'm hearing the music, so I can't really finish the question. We'll come back to it in a minute. We're going to stand by now, take our final break of the day, and then when we do come back, we'll wrap up our topic of lunar science, lunar engineering, super cold stuff, and all of the kind of work that is being done by the folks at Flexer Engineering. Plus, we'll take a look at our local launch forecast. So stay tuned for that. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. With a quick reminder, you can stay in touch with us throughout the week online. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. If you're on Twitter, our hashtag is Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping about everything having to do with the program, visit WMMBAM.com, enter in keywords Space Talk, and you'll go right to our website there on the radio program website. To continue along with our program today, let's do stop now for a moment and take a weekly look at the local launch forecast. I mentioned earlier the planned launch of the Delta IV from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Want to make sure everyone keeps that top of mind as our United Launch Alliance friends and neighbors work to get that booster off the ground. But closer to home, the calendar has shifted a bit since we talked last week. The Atlas V launch that was set to go on April 27th has now moved about 1 week to the right and is now targeted to fly on May 5th. Actually, I should have said something about it last week, but I didn't know yet. And as I was talking about the old April 27th date, Adrian Lafitte from Lockheed Martin, who was present in the studio here at the time, sitting behind me, was waving his hands furiously trying to get my attention, but I didn't see him. So for all of you who were listening last week and were more up-to-date than I was, I do apologize. In any case, with the Atlas V launch of its military communications satellite now set for Cinco de Mayo, that makes the next planned launch from the Space Coast the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, which is set to fly on April 30th at 12:22 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The Falcon 9 will be carrying the company's Dragon spacecraft to a rendezvous with the International Space Station, and if all goes well with the rendezvous, the crew aboard the station will be allowed to reach out to Dragon with a robot arm, grab hold of the unmanned cargo ship, and then berth the thing to the to a docking port at the orbiting outpost. This is all part of NASA's new way of doing business of commercially procuring cargo delivery services in place of the shuttle. And it is extremely important to note that this is a test flight. Repeating, this is a test flight. No one hopes things go wrong, but you should know that by the very nature of a test flight, sometimes unexpected things do happen, so we will hope for the best. We will discuss this when we get a little closer to launch, but there are a lot of eyes on this particular space shot, and while I would hate to think anyone would actively hope for something to go wrong, there's no denying there is a segment of the space community and more than a few members of Congress who are ready to pounce on SpaceX and what it represents should there be a problem. So we'll just keep our fingers crossed on that. Hey, one other launch to note of sorts anyways. It stands now, weather permitting, of course, on Tuesday, April 17th at 7 a.m. Eastern Daylight, the Space Shuttle Discovery is scheduled to depart the Kennedy Space Center atop a NASA 747 shuttle carrier aircraft for its trip to the National Air and Space Museum in Washington. As I understand the plan now, the 747 is going to take off at about 7 a.m., plan to make a pass, a low pass, up and down the beach. If they do the normal route, probably as far as south as Patrick Air Force Base. So if it all works out, this is a great chance and one of your last chances to go outside and see what to me is truly one of the most amazing things you'll ever witness associated with our space program. Once again, Discovery's departure now set for Tuesday morning, April 17th at about 7 a.m. Again, for information about all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look to the link to our launch forecast. With just about 3 or 4 minutes left to talk about lunar science and lunar engineering with the folks from Flexure Engineering, Bonnie DeBrow is in our studio. Russell Cox, Gregory Scharfstein joining us on the phone from Points West. Bonnie, we want to talk a little bit and give you a chance to talk some more about what you're doing on the Space Coast. And especially you've got some part of the thing that you talked about earlier about arranging conferences and whatnot, getting the right people together to talk. What's your plans on that? What's ahead? What's coming up for you guys here in the near term here on the Space Coast?
Near term here on the Space Coast, Greg is going to be coming in to do a debrief on the workshop we just completed in Texas called the Lunar Superconductor Applications Workshop. And we are planning on doing the third international version, what we call LSA-3, here in Brevard County next mm-hmm. year. We're also planning a Lunar Cubes workshop out in Ames in Mountain View, where that technology has been a big topic of focus. And
can I break you there? And, sure. And you said Lunar Cubes. Give me the 10-second game show version if you can. What is a Lunar Cube?
Lunar Cube is a small satellite, and you're going to have to talk to the guys about the rest of the detail of that.
CubeSat we're talking about.
CubeSats.
CubeSats. Yeah. Last week, you asked why the moon. Last week's show, kids get really excited, and they can even be engaged in CubeSat-level experimentation. We're going to have a workshop, and Flexure's going to help bring CubeSats to Lunar CubeSats.
Okay. Oh, see, that's excellent. That's great. So this stuff going on now, you know, we're talking, our audience, of course, represents a wide range of folks interested in the space program. This is the kind of stuff that the general public doesn't really want to show up for. I wouldn't say they're not necessarily not invited, but it's probably something that, you know, some specialists in these fields are the folks that attend these kind of conferences. Is that right?
For the LSA program, that's true. It's leading scientists and engineers in cryoengineering, lunar science, superconductivity. The CUBES workshop is more for more of the general public, still people that are excited about space and getting involved. We're wanting to include everything from high school students to students in college, grad students, as well as the professionals in aerospace.
Fine, with just about a little less than a minute to go with you folks in our time today. As you continue to grow as a company and work, are there opportunities to work at Flexer here on the Space Coast? You mentioned the virtual company earlier. You're kind of spread all around right now.
We do. We are actively building relationships with Florida Tech, with Kennedy Space Center, and several of the startups here, and want to help the Space Coast shine as we move into the next activities that are happening here on the Space Coast, in the country, and around the world to go to the moon and beyond.
Let's wrap up with you and give us a good plug for how to get more information and where can they go online.
Go online to lsa2013.com, lsa2013.com, and that's the website for the superconductor application, and lunarcubes.com for that workshop.
Bonnie DeBrow, Russell Cox, Gregory Sharfstein, thanks for being on the program with us, guys, on the phone, taking your time on Sunday afternoon to talk with us. And we wish you all best of luck and good fortune as we go explore the moon.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Hey, next Sunday is Easter, so we will not have a live show as my family and I celebrate this most important day to our faith. So the plan is to present a special best of edition of Space Talk, which I hope you'll find informative, entertaining, and perhaps a little nostalgic. We'll be back with a live show on April 15th. That's all for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus, SpaceX, and United Launch Alliance. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, for a Best of Space Talk edition. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.